Hey, today's show is brought to you by one of my favorite, if not my favorite, sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off of your order. And this week, Sunset Lake CBD has basically sponsored the recovery of my eczema. I know that's not what they pitch it for, but they have a great salve with Arnica that you're supposed to use for your muscles. I don't have muscles, but I do have eczema. And so just because when you get it, it itches so much, you're just like, I'll put anything on it. And I put it on one day, and it not only eased the pain, it started healing it. And so I use it whenever I get too much sun and I get some eczema. But also my sleep today, brought to you by SunsetLakeCBD.com. Their tincture. They have a new, 6,000 milligram tincture? Is that what it is? And it is a wonderful way to get to sleep. That is far more natural than the pharmaceuticals that I've used in the past to get to sleep. They have it in multiple flavors. They have it in natural and citrus and mint. But they also have smokables and kief and pre-rolls. They have CBD fudge, CBD coffee, CBD gummies. They have it all, and their products have an incredible amount of integrity. They are tested by third-party testers. You can see exactly what you're ingesting. It's on their website for every one of their products. They have great business practices. They have donated a ton of cash to all sorts of union strike funds. The Nurses Union in Worcester, incidentally, update on that. They maintain their union. The scabs did not vote out the union. That was really excellent. But they also have donated a lot of money to give directly. We've done all sorts of different programs with them. They're a great company, great business practices, great farming practices, organic no pesticide in their CBD. So check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off. And now, for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 4th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post columnist Perry Bacon. And then, I guess, comedian, animated superstars, John Hodgman and David Rees. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine agree to create humanitarian corridors, but Russia continues to shell civilians. Meanwhile, Russian bombing of Ukrainian nuke power plant, Europe's biggest, causes no radiation leak. U.S. offers a temporary protected status to Ukrainians. Not so much with Haitians. Meanwhile, Senate members of the fossil fuel cartel seek to ban Russian oil. Federal job report. Jobs are surging. Gain of 678,000. Rate falls to 3.8%. Almost every job lost over COVID is back. Biden signs a bill to end forced arbitration in workplace sexual harassment cases, announces a new Buy American rule for government purchases. Meanwhile, Florida legislator passes abortion ban, and students across the state walk out over the possible Don't Say Gay law. Biden administration announces COVID test to treat program. NFL drops COVID protocols. And a report, Black New Yorkers hospitalized at twice the rate of white New Yorkers during the Omicron surge. Sacklers and Purdue reach a new deal with states' attorney generals over the opioid crisis. And New York's Soho REI is the first in the country to unionize, as the New York Times tech folks vote to unionize themselves. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Casual Friday. As such, I am wearing my soft-collared shirt. Emma, of course, not even wearing collar today.
I'm like essentially wearing pajamas.
Zubaz? Is that what that is? Zubaz?
I mean, it's like, you know, it's a Henley, like, I mean, look how loosely fitted it is.
I don't know what that means.
I mean, and I'll even be honest, Sam, I took my shoes off.
All right. Okay, that's good to know. Wondering what was going on in the studio. We got a lot to get to today. Very excited to both have Perry Bacon on and Hodgman and Rees. It's been a long time since John Hodgman's been on this program. David Rees we've had not too long ago. I think this is the first time for Perry Bacon, but I've been reading his stuff in the Washington Post. We wanted to get him on for a long time. Don't know why it's taken so long, frankly. Let's get to this. As you know, there is an enormous, we've had really, in many respects, unprecedented sanctions against the Russian government. Maybe even perhaps more devastating for the Russians is both something that's happening in the private sector in terms of leases and relationships that they have with aeronautic companies, I guess, basically makers of airlines. There are some Russian planes that they use domestically. A lot of their planes are either American or European, and they're not getting the supplies and the know-how, help in terms of servicing. So that's going to dramatically impact their air travel capacity. And now, as of yesterday, two major shipping container companies, Maersk and MSC, have stopped delivering their containers to Russia. Part of this is also that in times of war, maritime insurance is automatically canceled. And so there are not going to be shipments in that entire sort of, I guess, various ports. We're not going to see anything in Odessa. We're not going to see things in other parts of the Baltic Sea. And this is also going to inhibit both commodities going in and out of Russia. However, that does not seem to be enough for those people who represent the fossil fuel industry in this country. Here is Joe Manchin, along with, this is clip number one, Joe Manchin, Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania, where a lot of that fracking, and I think what's her face senator from Alaska. What's her name?
Murkowski,
also in on this. You just, where they're basically digging up either the coal or the oil. That's basically, those are the people who are just suddenly really excited about banning Russian oil. Here is that.
You need the horsepower to run a country. You need the horsepower to be the superpower of the world and be able to have your allies depend on you. And we haven't been there for that. We've throttled back and never throttled back up. That's all I'm saying. And I'll just say this for my own. I would gladly, if ever was a poll being taken, they said, Joe, would you pay 10 cents more a gallon to support the people of Ukraine and stop basically the support of Russia? I would gladly pay 10 cents more a gallon.
Joe Manchin would pay 10 cents more a gallon. That means like he's not going to be able to take his yacht out as much. Or what was it? What was it? Lamborghini?
He had the Lambo SUV, right? I mean, like a big, big Lambo.
Yeah, it's all well and good for him, but it's not so much Joe Manchin paying 10 cents a gallon more. We already are seeing oil prices already shoot up. This would increase it. There was some reason why Joe Manchin did not want to provide child tax credits for the vast majority of American families in this country, literally payments of $200-$300 per child for the vast majority of Americans in this country. And he didn't want to provide all sorts of support for Americans, extended unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. I can't remember what it was. Do you remember, Emma, what it was, the reason?
First it was COVID, then it was entitlements, but he did settle on something in particular called inflation.
Inflation. And here he is literally talking about, I personally will choose inflation to be able to increase fossil fuel production in this country. And let's be clear here. When we hear this talk of we need to be energy independent, so we need to drill more in this country, understand that is a total, total lie. If someone suggests that we need to be energy independent, and that involves more extraction of fossil fuels in this country, the next thing out of anyone's mouth in the room or within earshot of that should be, and of course, we'll need to nationalize these things, because we're not going to allow these private entities that dig this oil or that pull this coal out of the ground or whatever it is to sell it on the international market. We need to nationalize this so that we keep it exclusively for Americans' use. And the only way to do that is to have the U.S. government essentially take over these industries and keep it from the private markets, and then we can talk.
That's got to be what Joe Manchin's advocating for, right?
I mean, perhaps.
No.
It's possible. But people should just be very, very skeptical about that. It is one thing, the implications, and like I say, when we're talking about container ships and we're talking about oil tankers, that is going to inhibit the export of Russian oil as it is. But the idea that Joe Manchin, and maybe it's a good idea to inhibit the export of Russian oil, but the idea that Joe Manchin has no problem with the 10 cents more per gallon of gas off the top is...
Well, he's in favor.
It takes a lot of balls.
He's in favor of inflation for things that he appreciates and that benefit him, as opposed to, like, I don't know, something like the child tax credit.
Indeed. All right, let's. We got to take a break in a moment. We've just got some sponsors. Bradley, we also have Shopify as well, too, don't we?
Okay.
We got three. Oh, yeah. Okay, right. We got three. Okay, great. So this is an ad, and I'm getting a little bit of feedback. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Not sure why that is. This is, I love this company because this, you know, every now and then we get ads that, that I've been using the product anyways. And fast growing trees is one of them. You got spring coming. You got summer nearing. It is time to make your outdoor space feel more like a yard and less of like a plant cemetery. When it comes to caring for plants, know-how matters. And that's why fastgrowingtrees.com's experts curate thousands of plant varieties that are going to thrive in your specific climate and location. You order online or over the phone, your plants are shipped to your door within 1 to 2 days. course, if you're living in, more northern areas, they're going to wait until it's planting season. Plus, their growing and care advice is available 24/7. Whether you're looking for increased privacy, shade, adding some natural beauty to your yard, maybe some fruit trees, fast-growing trees have the perfect plants and expertise to help you find them. Even if you've never had a green thumb, they'll make you feel like you do. 1 million home gardeners have already seen what fastgrowingtrees.com does for them. Plus, they have a 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee. You can trust everything will be healthy for years to come. I literally just encouraged my buddy, Fast Growing Trees. I said, just wait until, because we're going to have a coupon code soon. But Fast Growing Trees is responsible for my Korean pear trees, my Arkansas black apple trees. And the thing is, I don't know if their trees actually grow any faster, but they have bigger ones that they ship. They figured out how to ship these things. They stay moist in their box for an extended period of time. You're supposed to take them right out. There are times I haven't been able to do that as quickly as I wanted to, but they're in great shape. And a lot of times you can get fruit in the first year, which is amazing. Just a couple, of course, and then you got to prune them down and this and that. But I got a great lilac that is a bloomerang. It blooms both in the spring and then in the fall again. They have all sorts of great trees and shrubs. Check it out. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority right now. You're going to get 15% off your entire order. That's fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. Get 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. Also, one button and I feel secure online. I do that on my iPad. I do it on my iPhone. I do it on my computers. Going online without ExpressVPN is like leaving your kids with the nearest stranger while using the restroom. You never truly know who you're trusting. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network, which is cafes, hotels, airports, you're traveling around, your online data is not secured. Any hacker on the same network can gain access to and steal your personal data. Hackers can make some serious cash selling personal info on the dark web, but ExpressVPN has made it easier than ever to keep your information safe. Simply fire up the app and click one button to get protected on all your devices, phones, laptops, tablets, and more. It's super easy, folks. A lot of times you hear VPN, you have no idea what it is. You get very uptight about it. I'm telling you, super easy. One press on your phone, you never have to think about it again. Same with your computer, same with your iPad. Plus, you're also keeping your ISP in the dark. Secure your online data today at expressvpn.com/majority. Get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn.com/majority, expressvpn.com/majority. And lastly, Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses. So if you're an upstart, you're a startup, you're established businesses, you can sell everywhere and synchronize your online and in-person sales and effortlessly stay informed. Even if you're a podcast selling merchandise. And incidentally, we have at our Shopify built merch store right now, #2 pencils available with a Majority Report logo. Shopify not only powers the Majority Report store, I should say, powers millions of businesses where retail sales are all that they do. And so they help from both your first sale to full scale. I mean, full on. You can reach customers online and across social networks. They have an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Plus, you gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility. It is powered by Shopify. Sell offline, online. You can completely integrate it. You get a sense of where your ads are performing best and your shop is performing best on Instagram or TikTok or wherever it is. Check it out. Go to shopify.com/majority. That's all low. And get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. That's shopify.com/majority. Check it out right now. All right, we got to take a quick break. And we need to, and then we will be back with Perry Bacon Jr., columnist at the Washington Post. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Washington Post columnist Perry Bacon Jr. Perry, welcome to the program. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, obviously this week we had it's been sort of a crazy week, both obviously with what's going on with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And we also had the State of the Union address this week. And I guess you could call this sort of an attempt at a reset for the Biden administration. I mean, really the biggest, almost the biggest thing, and what ultimately might be the most sort of important, was an attempt to basically say, without explicitly saying COVID is over, sort of that COVID is over. But we still have, and you wrote about this week, this ongoing fight in the Democratic Party that has been, I guess, ongoing for quite a while. But it does feel like the progressives have, there's been enough pushback that there's a little bit of panic from the center of the party. And you write about sort of the attempt by the establishment, conservative, moderate, whatever you want to call them, Democrats, to, I can't tell, will you tell me, is this a backward looking argument or a forward looking argument in terms of trying to set up potential failure at the midterms?
It's both on some level. I guess the piece gets into the idea that the centrists say defund the police killed us in 2020. There's very little evidence for that, but I think they're trying to sort of pin defund on the left. And if the 2022 elections are lost, they'll say it's partly because you guys were for defund, even though very few, you know, prominent national progressives are actually for defund. I think the piece got into sort of this idea that wokeness is killing the Democratic Party, which, again, it's hard to define wokeness in the first place. But if we kind of go with a but it's not clear that's actually really, if wokeness means talking about racial issues, then I guess we could say that from 1965 forward, that's hurt the Democratic Party. But if it means saying Latinx, then I'm a little more skeptical. That's playing a lot of election results. And then this sort of education is killing the Democrats, you know, school closures, maybe critical race theory, maybe, you know, changing how admissions work in high schools, elite high schools. Just, again, not a lot of strong evidence. These are, in other words, what I'm hinting at in the piece, and maybe I could be more explicit about, is you have a lot of Democrats are not doing as well as they hoped in 2022, in 2021, or sorry, in 2020, they did a little worse than they thought. In 2020, even though they won, in 2021, they lost in Virginia, struggled in New Jersey, and 2022 looks like a bad year. And we're now seeing, I think, a pre-blame game. And I think the center is probably better positioned and being more aggressive in doing the blaming.
In the fall, and we feel like defund is hurting us, even though, as you say, there's very little evidence for that. And so they had Biden come out aggressively and say, like, you know, I'm against defund, when there was no need even to really talk about it. He just brought it to the fore. And in the end, the Republicans still attack him and say Biden and the Democrats are for defunding the police. So it's just a way to kick the left, and I don't see the value in it, honestly.
So I guess I probably agree that it's not necessarily new that the left is kicked. I think what's new, in my view at least, is the focus on data is part of it. Like, you have like a group of people who are very focused on my special data, my polls. I don't think in 1996 or 2006 that was as clear that we had. I did these special polls which showed Latino voters move right based on this one phrase that I can. And I actually view Biden a little bit differently, which is I don't actually think that he is necessarily trying to choose sides. I actually think he's around so many establishment moderate Democrats who say to him all the time, the left is killing us, Deepa. I think he genuinely might believe that, you know, saying what he said is going to help. I don't see much evidence for that. But I think if your entire circle is these kinds of Democrats who've told you you won in 2020 because you pushed the left aside, I actually think he might be less cynical than other people doing this are.
Well, let me ask you about this. What do you think the impact of him saying that will be? I mean, because on some level, I mean, look, I'm with Emma. I think it was gratuitous, but he said it. And supposedly this is what the moderates wanted. This was going to be the cure-all, right? I mean, and so did he, and I agree with you. I don't think that he's, I think he's basically, you know, his engagement in this stuff, I think, is of a different sort than maybe, let's say, a Josh Gottheimer. Let's put it that way.
This is what I'm getting at. Right. That's a good name to pick, in fact. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's always been a sieve as far as I'm concerned. And he's surrounded by these people and he thinks he's helping the Democratic Party here. But is he also maybe, did he also inadvertently undercut the moderates, bless you, the moderates' ability to say this is a problem? Because on some level, like, right, like, it's the Chuck Todds, with all due respect to Chuck Todd, although not.
I think you should have a lot of respect for Chuck Todd, but anyway, right.
But it's those ilk of people who have been sort of like echoing, you know, Josh Gottheimer doesn't have any more access to any, you know, to the people, to the narrative than, let's say, AOC does, maybe, except for those talking heads who respond to that. Did Joe Biden undercut that project of being able to blame any type of failures on defund or wokeness or something like that?
I mean, it should have. Obviously, the president saying we don't believe in defund in a huge speech.
And he said obviously, it like 12 times. Like
12 times. He already said it a bunch of times. He said it also in 12 times in 2020. So I think
fund them over and over again.
So I think in a rational world, if Abigail Spanberger or Elaine Luria lose their elections, they cannot say, well, the left said defund seven times and therefore people in my district thought I was. Obviously, they should not be able to say that. And, you know, a rational person would be like, maybe not. It's not a great, great argument, but no. I think those people will literally invoke defund again when they lose, because I think this is so easy to discredit the left on. And I think if you're debating whether, you know, in some ways we're watching a pretty intense intra-party fight, I think. And so I don't think people are going to like defund is such a toxic, it doesn't poll well. Black people, it doesn't poll that well among black people even. So I really do think it's like such a powerful, Clyburn has said defund is important, you know, bad. So I think it's such a powerful wedge for the center to attack the left on. I think it'll come up next January too, unfortunately.
Characterize for us what this fight within the Democratic Party is. Because, I mean, you know, like, I don't get the sense that there is a huge market out there for this argument about the Democrats not performing well because of defund or even wokeness on some level. I mean, I think it's there on the conservative side, but within the universe of potential voters for Democrats, or as we get narrowed down, right, this argument is deployed for a narrower set of people, it seems to me. And within the context of that, like, who is this fight between?
I don't think this is a fight about voters at all. I think this is a real intra-party fight. This is basically about, did you support Elizabeth Warren or Sanders? Did you not? And I think it goes to a level of kind of who should be listened to. Like, on some level, like, did inflation happen, and was it because of the checks, is an empirical issue that we could debate. I think, should you listen to Jason Farman or Stephanie Kelton, is the actual debate we're having. Should you listen to Nicole Hannah Jones or Matt Iglesias is the debate we're actually having. Should you listen to David Shore or Steve Phillips is the, should you listen to the black people or the white people is often a little bit often a more precise way to get at that, but I don't say that, but there are some, you know, cross racial debates here, but in my view, a lot of this is the sort of fight racial inequality really sharply view get really strong in sort of June 2020. It's increasingly hard. If you don't think affirmative action is good, if you don't think the party should be focused on racial equity, it's no longer easy to oppose that directly. So what you can, if you're a Democrat, so what you can say is, I agree with you guys on reparations. I agree with you on racial equity. I agree with you on the policing. It just doesn't poll well. I mean, that's what you can say instead. And I think that's what, if you read a lot of the arguments, that's what you're really hearing is, there are things I'm uncomfortable with, and how do I oppose them? Here are my poll numbers.
Now, but I guess what I'm asking is, who's the you in this? When you say, like, should you listen to Stephanie Kelton or Jason?
Should Joe Biden? Should regular Democratic voters? Should Joe Biden, I think, in person? Should Joe Biden? It's not should the Nancy Pelosi. I think there is actually, Joe Biden is pretty, if you compare his speeches in 2021, 2022, I know he's a centrist, but his speech in 2021 actually was full of talk about race. His speech in 2022 was absent of it. Joe Biden and Pelosi are actually pretty, and most Democratic voters are actually pretty fluid in terms of what they will support. And I think that's the argument we're having here.
Who are the ones who are lining up in those camps? Is it an ideological divide, or is it, I mean, because I am of the mind that much of this is almost a rear guard fight by people who are making money, really the consultant class in the Democratic Party, it seems to me, right? I mean, because ultimately, like you say, Joe Biden's just looking around and hearing voices in his ears, right? And who's in that room at any given time, I think to a certain extent, yes, is going to influence what he's coming out with. But the people in that room, they want to be in that room, and maybe not so much for Joe Biden at this moment, maybe Joe Biden, but also for all these other candidates, because they're going to get they're going to get knighted, or they're going to get some type of blessing from the Senate reelect committee and the congressional reelect committee. And there's a lot of money to be made here for these individuals, and they want to be the ones in that room, right? I mean, is that, but give me your sense of who those players are.
So my sense of this is much more, let me be careful here because he works with me, but it's much more about Larry Summers or Stephanie Kelton and less about the consultant class. Generally has a general view that you should turn out more voters, you should be toward the middle, but they actually, the consultants give sort of, the consultants work for Stacey Abrams, Raphael Warnock, Mandela Barnes, but also Josh Gottheimer. I think they're open. The consultant class, I don't think, is religiously open because making more money means you have to work for progressives and for centrists. I think it's actually not that. I think it's a little bit at the intellectual level, which is more sort of, sort of who is wrong and whose theories on X and Y. Yeah, I think actually happen to think it's at the party level, Gottheimer versus AOC, like who should lead the party in the future? I think those are the Hakeem Jeffries or AOC. I think there is a participant level part of it too, but I actually think it's like those people, like who's the Pelosi generation is retiring. So who gets to have the mantle for them and why? And if you are able to pin defund on AOC and those people, you can say these people have dumb antenna for politics. We have to have us, the sort of normal, the young people who are normal and not the young people who are radical left. That's why I think the debate is actually playing out. Who should be in charge?
So talk about like the idea that progressives are losing this, because on some level, I mean, when Gottheimer says the radical left over here, AOC, which I don't think that she's particularly radical, And me, the normal guy, and frankly, I think he's not normal. Like, you know, he is representing, I mean, aside from him, I think being like a not normal in a very social way, and he also
weird guy. Yeah.
He's representing some of the wealthiest interests in the country in his district. And it is animating every decision he makes.
Yes. So if we frame this in terms of how much should the status quo of, we're echoing a little bit. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are we getting, we're getting an echo for some reason now. Did anything change? Because I'm getting a little bit of an echo, and Perry is too.
I didn't move. So, okay. No. So better now.
Eh. Okay, go ahead.
All right. So it seems to me that the divide is over. Like, let's say the status quo in America tends to result in men and white people having more power. And I think that the sort of AOC wing wants to change that aggressively. And the sort of Josh Gottheimer wing wants to change that a little less aggressively. And that's sort of, so even like using the terms left and center have some usefulness, but I really think it's like, who wants to sort of burn down Wall Street and who wants to pretend to burn down Wall Street, but really keep it in place. I mean, what was your question? I feel like I didn't answer it. I feel like I'm repeating.
Well, no,
this.
I mean, like, how are progressives doing in terms of progressives doing? So, because we should not be thinking about Josh Gottheimer as the normal one.
So I would argue not particularly well, but I think that's because the media class and the wealth class of the country are aligned with the centrist. So arguments that are like defund is a bad idea can sort of run through the rest of the media really quickly, in part because the media, the editorial boards, the biggest columnists, Morning Joe, all those people are in position to sort of reinforce those arguments. Like, defund is bad seem natural to those people. Wokeness is killing the Democrats seem natural to people because they don't like their woke employees. Like, this is, so in some ways, the left's problem is that the center narratives are going to be repeated in the media and repeated by the big donors and repeated by the Michael Bloombergs. And I think that's the problem, is that Eric Adams against Maya Wiley is kind of not a fair fight, because Maya Wiley's arguments can be cast as crazy and left. And Eric Adams in the press, like, most voters are not particularly ideological and don't know what's going on. So whoever becomes the sort of regular Democratic candidate who the sort of Democratic machine supports will get voters on both the progressive and the centrist side. But if the message is the regular Democrats are sort of closer to Hakeem Jeffries or closer to Josh, and AOC is kind of not a regular Democrat, that's a disadvantage for AOC.
I don't want to harp on this point about the consultants, because I think your point is taken. They need to be able to work. They need to be mercenary on some level if they want to make their money. But there is an argument that the nature of a progressive candidacy ends up putting less money into the pocket of a consultant.
I think that's correct.
Because yes. Of the nature of the way that they maybe might be more grassroots oriented, less TV buys. I mean, it's just the way that these things are structured.
Also, and, I should say, just to add, like, the black, there's a blacklisting element of it too, that, you know, went down where there, that, like, you know, that there's an understanding, say if you work with somebody who's primarying a sitting Democrat, you're less likely to get work with the rest of these Democratic candidates going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that challenge, but I'm talking like almost like structurally, all things else being equal, you're going to make more money off of somebody who is, you know, raising corporate money, A, and B, looking to an air campaign versus a ground campaign when it comes to politics. There, and I wonder if, in addition to that, you know, there was a piece by Will Bunch, I'm sure you're aware of, in the Inquirer. At least, I don't know if you read this piece, but and he was basically, you know, imagining an ad that could be deployed by congressional candidates where they would invoke MLK and they would invoke Rosa Parks and say, Republicans are trying to keep this out, like, engage in that culture war that Republicans have successfully sort of dragged our politics back into after a couple of like sort of blanks, you know, Dr. Seuss didn't stick, but we found something. And engaging in that and rolling it in with Trump and Putin and this and that. Why don't we see that? I mean, it seems to me there's a generational divide here too.
Sure.
Which is like you mentioned a Spanberger. There are times where Spanberger and AOC are actually aligned. It seems to me against a Pelosi, even though their ideological politics don't there, but their perception of partisanship is different. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. Spanberger makes it a little more complicated, but let me sort of come to what I think is going on here is that, and the reason I don't want to blame the consultants is in part because the consultants don't get to, you know, there's people who are able to speak and write columns and it's easier to know what they think than the consultants. But the other issue is at this point, the consultant class is people who agree with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, their view of politics. So I'm not sure that the consultant class might have their own ideology based on money making. At this point, the consultant class has been curated to people whose general views are theirs. And the general views of those people, the people who have run the Democratic Party my entire adult life functionally, are race, culture, abortion, women's rights, all those issues are bad for us. So we need to focus on kitchen table issues. So we need to talk about healthcare, jobs. And if anytime it's culture war, Republicans win. Anytime it's Democrat, anytime it's anything else, anytime it's jobs, Democrats win. This is not true. And in the reason you can think that most is 2018 was not about healthcare. The healthcare plan died in September 2017. 2018 was about, do you hate Trump or do you like Trump? And there were masses of people who didn't like Trump. We had these huge, Trump was this huge cultural identity figure. And we had the hugest elections of all time, which Democrats turned out in massive numbers. The lesson was not, we should roll out our boring plans and talk about our bipartisan roads plan. I don't know. But again, this is like they have an almost religious belief in that you win elections by talking about how bipartisan you are and talk about your jobs plan. And this did not work in 2010, 2014, 2016, et cetera. But I don't think until this generation, in some ways that is maybe not Abigail Spanberger, but I think there are some people who I would call, like, if you look at John Fetterman or Connor Lamb, who are running in Pennsylvania, those are not like left-wing people, but they are younger people. And therefore, like, I think Fetterman's running on marijuana legalization, which Biden is very terrified of. I do think there's a generational element, which is that the old guard is very much like basically running the 92 campaign, 90 Clinton campaign over and over again. So, and Tuesday was the new sister soldier was fund the police, because that's the way to do it. And so that's their view. And I think the ideology divide captures something, but I think there are sort of non-AOC Democrats who would run on the other guys want to ban books and attack Rosa Parks, and we want to defend Rosa Parks and let your kids read. That's not a left-wing argument, but it's not a kitchen table argument, which means Pelosi is not going to be inclined to do it.
But there's also I'm sorry, go ahead, Emma.
No, it's just someone like I'm just curious why you feel that way about Fetterman, given, like, you know, he's running as a pretty aggressively pro-union candidate. I believe he's a Medicare for All supporter. And marijuana legalization, yeah, like, that's widely supported in the country, but not by the president of the United States. You know, what's your feel for that race then?
I think he's plenty left wing. I guess what I'm saying is he's probably not identified in the public the way it would as an AOC candidate. That's all I meant is like, but he's running in a, even Connor Lamb is sort of more leaned into like voting rights than the party is what all I'm trying to get at. So my feel is I don't know who's going to win that primary, and I'm not sure it. I tend to think that candidates don't matter a ton, and that we're, and that people and that the environment and the party labels matter more. So I'm not wedded to the Fetterman versus Lamb, who's better or worse necessarily. But all I'm getting is I think that Sam is right, that I think there's a generational thing that is unique here, that is important here.
Gotcha.
And I think that's a good, I think the idea, the concept that our consultant class they're all motivated by money on some level, but that they're curated with a specific ideological or just methodological, I don't know, like approach to politics, which is as ossified as the people that hired them at this point, with all due respect to people who are, you know, the few people remaining who are older than me.
I have a lot of consultant friends. I don't think they usually don't advocate saying defund the police, but I don't know that if they were in a group together, they would be like, you should say fund the police, because their general view is the Democrats have to win the base and win the swing voters. So that's their idea, is that the Pelosi Biden thing tends to sort of say, well, we gave swing the voters. Black people a Supreme Court nominee in January. They're going to be with us now, and let's focus on swing voters. Versus, I think the new updated form among the consultant class is turnout matters and swing voters matter, and don't do anything that's going to, you know, some of our foot soldiers on the ground who are going to turn out the vote in Georgia, either they or their friends are defund people. So let's not piss them off, because we're not going to say, there's a difference between saying defund and saying fund in a huge speech. And that middle ground is to stop talking about it and to say we have a criminal justice approach that involves investing the community, investing the police. He's already been doing this pretty well. I didn't know why he needed to do the sort of right. I actually think Biden most of the time has been pretty, you know, more balanced. That was sort of a more aggressive move, which tells me that at the end of the day, this is a president advised by, you know, Bruce Reed and people like that from that era. And I think it's worth, like, I think the 92 and 96, you know, they're formative. Like, we still have the guy who opposed busing and who wrote the crime bill is the president. And it's like worth, he may have admitted those things. He may not be proud of those moments of his career right now, but his political instincts are still kind of don't be too black is still part of his thinking about politics.
Yeah, it is amazing how old the Democratic leadership is. I mean, and static. I mean, there has been half a dozen leaders of Republicans in the House over the time that Nancy Pelosi has been the leader in for the Democrats. I mean, this is it's nuts in many respects. All right, so let's I do want to just actually turn to that Supreme Court justice that you mentioned, because you wrote a piece on that. I think it's today, actually. But before we do, just lastly, so where does this go? I mean, and I would imagine also, you know, you mentioned that you're skeptical about the difference of a specific candidate can make in particularly maybe in this environment. I also think there's something to be said for deliverism, you know, at the very least, it may be not necessarily specifically the material benefits, but the idea of like, we're doing something. Like it seems to me that what hurt Joe Biden's numbers over the course of that summer was less about the specifics of the Build Back Better bill and more about the fact that he was just getting toyed with by the Republicans and then by Sinema and Portman and then by Manchin. Like, he's just like a plaything.
I agree wholeheartedly. The first 5 months, we're getting vaccines, we're passing bills, we're doing executive orders. It was like Action Hero Joe from like, you know, January to June. Whether you thought the substance was great or not, the American public got the view that, oh, this guy's doing stuff. Yep. And then the Afghanistan stuff went badly in August. I think that's part of it. But I do think part of, and the variant is one of the variants came, but I do think a big part of it was just, he became bogged down in a show, a movie that he's kind of watching that is directed by with star actors or Sinema and Manchin, you know, and nothing is happening. And the fact that the shocking part being the exact same thing happened in 2009, like what was like, it's just shocking.
The amazing thing about it is they spent the first 4 months of their administration saying, we learned the lesson of the Obama administration. And now that we've had this, all the success, we're going to invite the Republicans to the White House and let them pitch Joe Biden. And then when that doesn't work out, we're going to allow Portman and Sinema to come in. And it was, I mean, it seems to me very, that is the pivot point. And we do not hear progressives even in that argument is not made, that the failure of this administration, I think, could all be tied to that moment where Joe Biden gave them more than 3 days to come up with an idea. And they should have just said, because every meeting that we heard about Joe Manchin having with the no labels people and the money people all came during that era. And it was just a period of time where we're going to give our opposition time to develop a strategy and to just play this out.
I guess the difference being that in 2009, Obama was waiting on Chuck Grassley. In 2021, Biden was waiting on Joe Manchin. I think the key thing is Joe Manchin portrayed himself as a member of the team. It's obvious that Chuck Grassley was not a member of the team, but I think Manchin. The White House people I know are pretty smart. I think the reason they spent so much time negotiating with Manchin was he was giving them hints that the answer might be yes to them, even if when he walked out of the room, the answer was no to everybody else. I think they were misled by a Democrat. Remember, Manchin in February said, "I want to make Joe Biden a successful president." He didn't honor that pledge, but I think he indicated that them privately. And so, like, if you look at Biden's statement he made about Manchin, or the Jen Psaki statement, it was scathing in a way that suggests Biden was kind of got burned and got tricked.
I mean, although with that said, Chuck Schumer supposedly had a letter from him in July saying 1.5 trillion or whatever it was, 1.7 trillion. I just think that, like, when you have that type of momentum, there's no reason to worry about, you know, sort of, we could get all this stuff passed, but maybe in 2 years, people will be mad that we didn't invite Republicans to be part of it. I mean, give me a break. I think it's just sheer insanity. All right. So with that said, let's turn to KBJ just for a moment. This is Joe Biden's nominee, not the one that was chosen to placate Lindsey Graham and Clyburn, for that matter. I suspect that is a function of unions feeling like the unions must have had a big part of that, I suspect, labor. In terms of Childs, and also just KBJ is just a much easier pick, it seems to me. She's already been approved by the Senate. But what's your perspective on this pick and the implications of it?
So I think she was always the pick, and in some ways that she was like 85% of the way there. Clyburn sort of, what do we do? Clyburn is our guy. I think there was a little confusion that he caused, but I think it was always trying to move them from their preferred pick. So I think that is where they landed. And I think she's got the right. I think the labor stuff did, the American Prospect reporting did sort of weaken Childs further, but I still think Jackson had the resume and was the person they were sort of always started on. In some ways they could have, in the same way Barrett was picked and everybody knew it, they could have announced Jackson in a week is my guess. And I'm not sure. I think Clyburn may have drawn at the process. This would actually probably happen. And my view on the pick is I wrote a piece that was, you know, it was a little mean probably, but basically saying Breyer had a pretty good record in my view, but the last year where he spent basically saying the court is nonpartisan, how dare you say the court is partisan, was sort of shameful and like, what was the point? And sort of really disappointing, and he sounded, you know, Biden's worst days when he's doing the Mitch McConnell's my friend, I love the Republicans and look how bipartisan I am. It was like, but Breyer spent like a year doing that, you know, whatever you like. I support adding judges to the Supreme Court or court packing, whatever you call it, very reluctantly. I don't think it's a good idea. I just think a court with Amy Coney Barrett, Kavanaugh, Alito and others is anti-democratic, anti-voting rights and so on. And if Breyer can't understand that or is so focused on pleasing his colleagues that he can't, like, he basically spent a year attacking progressives for honestly discussing how the court works. I found it outrageous.
Well, I mean,
go ahead, Dan.
Just like to be honest, there we're talking about the generational divide in the Democratic Party, regardless of ideology. There seems to be a divide generationally with some of these judges as well, in unwillingness to recognize like the scope of the monster that they're dealing with on the right. Like, you know, one of the things that excites me about Ketanji Brown Jackson is like the fact that she came from a different path than past justices, if she does get confirmed, hopefully. The fact that she represented Guantanamo Bay prisoners and that she was a you know, a public defender, but above all as well, it's hopefully a real reckoning and understanding that a judgeship is not a priesthood and that you're not above the fray to this degree. Breyer is so committed to his own BS and sniffing his own fart, sorry to be gross, that like that's indicative of like a lot of the way that these Supreme Court justices view themselves.
And I can't tell if that's ideological or generational, because we've had this in a couple times in the conversation. I assume your ideology and your generation are sort of, and your sort of view of status quoism, these things are all related, and teasing out exactly which one, like my guess is Breyer is probably, he's older than Sotomayor, but my guess is he's probably to the right of her on, they're both liberal, but he's to the right of her on issues. And my piece kind of hinted, if you're a rich, white, older man, that might point you in that direction. But Bernie Sanders is a rich, white, older man at this point. So I'm not sure that's conclusive, but I think that might point you. But I a public defender who's a black woman born in 1970 is going to be less wedded to the status quo than Stephen Breyer.
Without a doubt. I mean, I think a white older guy can believe the, I mean, the thing that encourages me about KBJ's varied experiences is that it expresses some notion of what we would call in law school critical legal studies, which is that maybe the system is not necessarily structured in such a fair way. Maybe there's a certain amount of jadedness, I think, that is associated with sitting on a sentencing committee and saying, I better check this out from the perspective of a public defender, without sort of believing that the system is working the way it is. I also think, frankly, I mean, Breyer has that, I think, that foundation of just believing, you know, that as a white guy, he probably overcame some measure of anti-Semitism as he was in law school of someone that age, but only enough to blind him from, I think, the impossibility of a lot of other people not being able to supersede what challenges were, obstacles were put in front of them because of their identities or where they were in society. And so it cut, I think, against his awareness of these structural things. And frankly, my sense was he wanted to sell his book. You were far more generous than I think that he deserved, particularly. I mean, I thought like Ginsburg should have resigned as well, but Breyer had at least the knowledge of what happened to Ginsburg. And for the fact for him not to do it is even more, I think, reprehensible. But knock on wood, at least we'll see, assuming that we can maintain an actual majority in the Senate until KBJ is confirmed. It worked out for Breyer and for the country to some extent, I guess. We're still probably another 10 years off from, a chance to balance out the court, if there's going to be any. But the last word, Perry.
The one thing I'm struggling with is the pledge. If you're the head of Asian American Group X in 2024 or 2028, and Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and X person are running, do you say we have not had an Asian American justice? We need one. And like I'm I guess on the one hand, I'm not sure that I know the Republicans have done this. I'm not interested in that. What I mean is, the Democratic coalition is very diverse. How does that kind of pledge, like if the promise came from Clyburn forcing you to do it, does that mean that Asian American groups, Latino groups should force similar promises? And how do we feel about that? That's one point. Second point, as a black person, who's applied for jobs, like so on, I am still thinking, what I want the Washington Post have announced, this is our black column of slot, here are the black applicants for it. That would be illegal, but even if it wasn't, you know, I'm grappling with that. Not that she's not qualified, I think she's very qualified. It's more of a question of how are white people going to perceive you if you're picked in this process is different than, I think a lot of people are qualified. I think she's very qualified again, but I think how are you going to be treated is an issue that I would want to think about. On the other hand, I think at the end of the day, this was a void. This was the fact that we hadn't had a black woman was an abomination. And I think that Biden being sort of upfront about this, I think affirmative action is good. So I think that the fact that he was sort of upfront, here's why I'm doing this and here's how, like, elevated Childs, elevated the other candidates, elevated Sherrilyn Ifill. So I think on balance, I think it was a good promise, but I'm not unequivocal about that.
Yeah, I think your number one is going to have more implications, frankly, than your number two, because it was such an obvious historical void that it transcends the idea of we have a, I mean, and listen, court watchers also, I can tell you, court watchers perceive that slot as the Jewish slot. Like, there was, like, the, you know, there has been this, you know, for those people who are, you know, sort of like in the legal circles, understood, you know, like they understand that dynamic that has existed for literally decades. It's just like who was allowed to get a slot was just much narrower. But the first one is an interesting one that I hadn't contemplated, that idea of, like, what are the implications going forward? How much of a historical void, an obvious void, do we need to justify a pledge like that from a candidate, and who's going to do it based upon maybe there's a specific state I need to win, and right, et cetera, et cetera. But fascinating stuff. Perry Bacon, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
This is great. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. I can see right now that David Rees and John Hodgman are in our green room, virtual green room. We're going to take a quick break. We will allow them to enter into the
broadcast.
The broadcast. I was going to keep up with the room.
Right.
The gold room.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll work on that. I'll take a break. We'll work on that. We'll be right back.
Yep.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report with Emma Vigeland. Apparently our audio was hot on the stream. So people heard about all of that, that secret stuff we were talking about. Joining us, it is a pleasure to welcome both of these guys back to the show in one form or another, but never simultaneously, I don't think.
Oh, this is the first time.
This is the first time they've come together. David Reese, John Hodgman,
yes.
Each from their own individual acclaim, but now reunited for their second season of a show called Dicktown. And I will let me just start preface this by
hashtag Dicktown, hashtag Dicktown, hashtag FXX 10 p.m. Thursday.
Okay, so
I'm a plug machine. I'm sorry.
I go to look for the show.
Yeah,
it's on Hulu.
Yeah,
and I'm told season two does not start until 4 a.m. last night or something, and so I don't watch it. But I'm thinking Dicktown, and on Hulu it says adult animation.
Yeah.
And I get a little confused. I'm going to be honest with you, because when I see adult animation, I have certain assumptions.
Especially with a name like Dicktown.
Why didn't you do it that way? Why wasn't it more dirty?
Why isn't it more erotic?
Yeah.
Erotic.
There's some
barf.
There's some erotic stuff later in the season.
I don't remember now.
You don't remember all the
sexy
stuff?
No, I'm blushing. Sam, I was the one who suggested this show should be called Dicktown, and I'm a very good boy. Yeah. I am the character that I play. John Hunchman is a weird only child grown up to be a weird only man. Does not swear very often, and that's true about me in life. And Dick isn't even a swear. I tell people it's old timey slang for detective because it is a detective show. But yeah, I feel uncomfortable every time I say the name of the show, Dicktown. But
that
is what we called it.
And we should also say it's a nickname for the actual town that your two characters operate in.
Yeah, that was Richardsville, North Carolina. That was a retrofit. That was just trying to justify the Dick and Dicktown.
I love that.
It makes a lot of sense. We have like three justifications for it. One, it's short for Richardsville. Dick is short for Richard. Town is short for Ville. Everybody knows that. Two, we play investigators solving mysteries for children, and private investigators used to be known as dicks, right? That's short for detectives, which is what we are. That's the second justification. Third justification, good, punchy name, great SEO. There's not much out there with that name. So that's good, too.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is that when you Google Dicktown, to my surprise, it goes to our show. That's the first thing that comes up. I'm really excited about that. Now, I discovered that there was a subreddit called Dicktown on Reddit that was not about our show, but was instead dedicated to one person. I'm going to guess man's illustrations, cartoons of private parts. But it turns out that guy's a big fan of both David and me. So someone in that community. Someone in that community said, hey, can we make this about the show Dicktown? And he's like, only if John Hodgman personally requests it. So what was I going to do? I wrote to the mayor of Dicktown and I said, please, can we make this a Dicktown subreddit? So if you want
to
find
the keys to your city,
give us the keys to your town. I mean, the truth is, may I be blunt?
Please.
This is a show about a former boy detective, Encyclopedia Brown style.
That's
boy
exactly
detective.
What I was going to say. This is Encyclopedia Brown.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All growed up.
For a while, I didn't want to say anything, but then I was like, yeah, let's have the Encyclopedia Brown estate come at us. That would be great. If they sued us, be great.
Best thing that could happen to you.
My character, John Hunchman, used to be a super smart, super sleuth when he was 15, 16, 17 years old, solving mysteries for his little friends, the mystery of the stolen hockey cards, the mystery of the stolen club trophy or whatever. And David's character, David Purefoy, used to be my bully and arch nemesis. And if you know Encyclopedia Brown, Sam, and it sounds like you might, he was the Bugs Meanie to my Encyclopedia Brown. Bugs. Yeah. Oh, Emma, good. Thank you.
I was an Encyclopedia Brown encyclopedia as a child. I was very into it.
And then I'll drop further knowledge that at the end of season one, a new character is introduced, a person from our mutual past, Heather Culbreth, who was my Sally Kimball, my co-detective when we were young, except Heather got recruited by the FBI to go solve real crimes, whereas my character just grew up and never left Dicktown. And by the time of season one, he is pushing 40 and still solving mysteries for teenagers.
Well, that's the other part, is that it was like Encyclopedia Brown and that character that what's-his-face played in the Linkletter film and the school. What was this? Not School Days. What was that? The Linkletter film.
Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused.
Yeah,
Matthew McConaughey.
He's just hanging around with the high school kids.
Yeah.
And this is, I was going to say, like, look, people who watch this show know that I do not like animation. I just don't like. Right. I don't watch animated shows. I've never.
You think it's unholy?
No.
You think it's
no,
an affront just, against the bodies that the creator gave us.
As a kid, I watched, like, you know, Super Friends and Bugs Bunny and Scooby-Doo, the whole thing. But when I got as an adult, I'm like, I miss the actors, like, performing this stuff. So I never watched I don't think I ever watched the full Simpsons. I never even watched it. Wow. I maybe watched one Bob's Burgers.
Oh,
so last night I tune in.
Good for Eugene.
Good for Eugene. I mean, it was one where I was on it, so I didn't.
Oh, okay, there you go.
I got to be clear. It was the Hugo episode where he's naked, and I sang during that, so that's why I watched that one.
Yeah, you got to sing it.
But last night I watched the most amount of contiguous animation I have ever watched in my entire life.
Wow!
Watch Rick and Morty. Watch us?
No, it was your show. I loved it. I really honestly loved it.
Thanks,
it
Sam.
Wasn't
That's
until
amazing.
I got to episode 4 of season 1 where Benjamin came on and then things went south for me. I don't appreciate it. I felt it was a little creepy. Like I didn't think he did a good job.
You understand.
Sort of brought the show.
Let me just say breaking news. We didn't want him. Obviously we didn't want him.
It was so apparent. There's
a law that John Benjamin's got to be on every animated show. We can't break the law, Sam.
Honestly, I was like, I can tell what's happening here. It's FX. It was like an Archer thing. He probably was guaranteed in his contract to be on any show that FX was producing at the time.
No, it's really industry wide. Any cartoon has to offer a role to John Benjamin, and he turns them down.
Yeah, it was really, really uncomfortable. And then I had to, I watched that episode, but to watch 44 minutes and there's no commercials. So this was, and Hulu sets them right up one after another. I really enjoyed the show.
Thank you.
The only thing I find curious is where does Reese, like, why, David, like, you're a bully? Like, that was a little hard for me to.
Oh, really?
Just the pushing, like, you were just, you don't come off as that physical, to be honest with you. Physically intimidating.
You don't think of me as a physical specimen? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying it was like a little bit. It was good that they, if it was not animated, it would have been tough to sell.
I see. I that character, you know, both of our characters are kind of exaggerated versions of ourselves. And in middle school and a little bit into high school, I was a bully.
Really?
I like to think I've grown out of it, but yeah, that's kind of, In fact, I've had conversations we worked this into the show later in that first season where I was at a bar or a dance party, and I ran into someone that I had gone to middle school with, and was like, oh, it's great to see you. We had so much fun in Miss So-and-So's civics class. And she was like, what are you talking about? You were horrible to me. You bullied me nonstop about my Bon Jovi t-shirt. That wasn't fun. We weren't friends. And I was like totally mortified. You know, it's like a awful thing to hear. Made a big impact on me, you know. And in fact, in this second season, in addition to the mystery of the week, we have an overall mystery that lasts the whole season, which is kind of about that. How two people can come away from something that happened in high school and have very different memories and very different interpretations of what it was. And one of those people, namely John's character, might not even remember what happened at all. So we try to deal with some of that stuff, you know, the kind of uncomfortable stuff about like, how do you reconcile being an adult with, you know, having been an asshole when you were a kid?
And but how I'm did you do that in your personal life? How did you do that in your personal life? I mean, how did, when did that change? People? Maybe I knew you after you had come to terms with what you, how,
I think
how much
so. Yeah. I tried. Yeah. You know, I was just, I wasn't beating, you know, I was in some fights, physical fights, but not a lot. And in fact, one time, we really going to get into this? Like one time in seventh grade, there was this girl who I used to really pick on, and she was taller than me. And after history class, seventh period, she was just sick of it. And she literally just body slammed me in the hallway. And it was like, I never picked on her again. You know, like everyone's always talking about Trump and Putin in terms of like, how do you stand up to a bully? What should we do? Should you try to placate them, or is there narcissism and family damage from generations of dysfunction just so profound that you can't reason with them? In my experience as a former bully, and I'm not saying that we should, I'm not saying we should establish a no-fly zone.
This is you,
like
and
that, but it's like,
hang
yeah,
on,
like
breaking news.
Me, like, it was over. She body breaking,
slammed me. Yeah, over. You and Lindsey Graham have the same approach.
Yeah, totally.
Wow.
In fact, I would be so excited to be in a think tank with Lindsey Graham, and we could reach across the aisle. Like, we could make a lot of money that way, and we could go on C-SPAN.
Let me ask you this question. This is since we're talking about Lindsey Graham, if you were in a think tank with Lindsey Graham, or let's say here's your opportunity. You can go out to dinner with Lindsey Graham, and he will be given a truth serum, and he will have to answer any question truthfully. But you can never reveal what he tells you. Would you do it?
No, it'd be too much. My head would explode.
You wouldn't want to carry around.
I'm horrible at holding on to secrets. I cannot keep
because the secrets that he must have.
Oh my God!
And that dapper little head.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one always
secrets he probably
hey,
even keeps
look,
to
I
himself.
Respect,
you know,
I respect a good haircut. Come on.
Fine haircut.
It's a fine $2 haircut, South Carolina
style.
I'd like
to know exactly what he was. Wasn't he? He was pretty big, if I remember correctly, in the Clinton impeachment. I wonder what he was involved in, like when he would leave the Hill after one of his speeches about morality that he was so uptight about. But David, I got to say, you know, this. It's going to take me a while to get over the fact that you're picking on girls in seventh grade.
Does that feel early or late?
That seems a little late, doesn't it, John? I mean, John, you have kids.
It seems like maybe another option is don't do it at all. Doesn't mind.
No, I mean, like, I can see like you're in first grade and you're pulling somebody's pigtail.
Pull a pigtail.
Seventh grade, you're 13 years old, David.
No, I certainly wasn't pulling any pigtails.
On the other hand, you're only 13 years old. Think about that.
All right.
John?
I can't defend my behavior. Yeah, it was a total, you know, I was a little.
You were a little stinker. You were a little stinker. You were a dick.
Yeah.
You were a
dick. I was a dick. Not to everybody, you know, and not all the time. And, you know, those types of things can be kind of fluid. Maybe you're nice to them one day and then the next day you turn on them or.
Doesn't sound like
picking
that.
On you, so you deflect. I don't know. I mean, how do you guys survive without
bullying? It sounds
people?
Like that, but it doesn't sound like that's the way you were.
I was a dick in high school as well, but only through inaction, because I was like my character. I was a weird only child who didn't get a lot of outside time, who mostly sat around pretentiously reading books in my garret, dreaming about being a middle-aged man because I was so terrified of sexual adolescence, and I was a narcissist. So anyone who dealt with me, I had a very strong image of myself as a good person. And mostly I was a very capable student, well-liked by all my peers and teachers. I was not, even though I wore a fedora to school and carried a briefcase, I was amazingly not bullied.
Did you wear a fedora?
Of course I did. And I had long hair. And I had long hair.
Massachusetts, right?
That's so much more offensive than bullying.
Brookline, Massachusetts.
I agree.
Oh, I know. It was loathsome. I mean, I couldn't have been more semi-literally asking for it. But I ended up years later realizing that I had hurt people who I didn't pay enough attention to, who I thought were below me, who liked me in one way or another, and I didn't even notice. And, you know, I think that that's the you know, when we talk about dicks and Dicktown, we're not talking too much about penises, if I am allowed to say that on a pod, on a radio, whatever this is, broadcast.
I had no idea.
No one knows anything anymore about what anything is. But we are talking a little bit about what it means to be a jerk and how to reckon with it. And that's what's happening. You know, David's character was a bully. My character ends up hiring him since he's the only person I know in town from that time, I end up hiring him as my driver and hired muscle. And we end up becoming friends because we're both working through the fact that we never properly grew up and we're stuck in this dick town, solving mysteries for teenagers and trying to figure out what you do to become a grown up. So, I called it Dick Town. I said Dick Town because one, there's a They Might Be Giants song called Can't Keep Johnny Down that has a lyric, all the dicks in this dick town can't keep Johnny down. And I became fixated on that as an idea. And then I also realized that we are on FX or FXX. It has a reputation for being subversive and provocative and hold no punches. But as you can see through this conversation, we're a couple of emo dudes. The show has a lot of heart. You know what I mean? It's got a lot of heart.
I am not a blowing smoke here. It is very rare that I watch any show, particularly their comedy, that I like anymore. Like I'm done. Like I can't. I don't. Whatever it is, I don't
appreciate that.
And the show is very political. It's also got a lot of social critique, and it does have this really great relationship in the middle. I really genuinely liked it. Like I say, like I'm 55 years old. I think I watched the longest stretch of animated television I've watched in probably 40 years. That's
incredible.
I was super drunk.
I couldn't live in the dream. I couldn't reach the remote.
55 years old, watching 44-minute blocks of comedy on Hulu with a drink in the middle of the night, waiting for season 2 to drop at 4 a.m. Woo! That's a big night for me, honestly, these days.
Television.
But yeah, I mean, I appreciate that very much, Sam. And, you know, the show is about relationships and it's about stuff, you know, and I was afraid that FX was kind of look at our scripts and just cancel it for being too sincere. So we wanted to lean into the grown-up cartoon space by just calling it something a little gross, Dick Town, to provide us some cover.
Well, the high school thing too, having high school kids as like the clients was also, I mean, I don't know how conscious you were of doing this, but it was also brilliant insofar as that it really gave an opportunity for some middle-aged guys. We're all middle-aged guys here. Feel safe in saying that.
Erasure right there. Wow. I
mean, well, Emma, not. I'm saying the
three of us, the three middle-aged guys here
on the show.
Right.
Yes. I want to throw that around.
It's funny because the show is really about challenging the centrality of the middle-aged guys in this cartoon.
Yes, yes, and it comes off quite well in that respect. Not so much on this show. Sorry about that.
No, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the idea. Is like, you know, the kids, quote unquote, you know, they're all better in the show Dick Town. For, you know, not only did we get to work with some incredible actors who are younger than us, who come from different backgrounds than us, Ronald Pete as Tucker, who's sort of our Q, who provides us with all our gadgets, Obehi Janice, who's plays Heather, who becomes our pal, Anna Akana, who's this incredible musician and actor, who's kind of the biggest star of the show, because you don't know because it's she's on Instagram and just destroying it there. You know, that was really great. But the best part was that all the teens, quote unquote, in the show are better at being grown-ups than we are, which I think is something that I've felt as a 50-year-old sort of dealing with the people who are in their 20s and 30s in my circle. In a lot of ways, I've often felt like, oh, you're better at being a grown-up than I am.
I feel that too, that this generation is just much more prepared for like the level of emotional intelligence of people at that age just seems to be significantly more than of our generation.
And the privileging of their own sort of happiness and life mission and tuning into what they want to do, because face it, they're in a world where they know very distinctly no one's going to help you. You are effed. All structures have that were designed to help people who look like us of our generation are not helping them. So it's like, why wouldn't they become self-fulfilled people? Because there's nothing else. Like, you can't find meaning in a job.
Their first 20 years were so much more chaotic than ours were. I mean, on a national geopolitical level, you know, putting aside whatever individual circumstances they had, but like, you know, I mean, they had 9/11 and they had the Iraq war and they had like multiple crazy recessions. And then they have this knowledge of, you know, environmental collapse and student loan debt is just completely different for that generation than it was for us. And then not to mention this worldwide pandemic where they realize like, oh, most people don't care if we live or die. Like, what? It's just like they're so much more battle hardened than we were. You know, it's insane.
It really is insane. I mean, Kurt Cobain died, and that was tough.
Right, right. I mean, we did have our burdens to carry, no doubt, but like, I don't know. And we had the Challenger, but the Challenger and 9/11 are just like on completely different scales, and they pertain to completely different things.
Grenada, for a while, was touch and go.
Yeah, Falklands.
I don't know if you remember, that was also...
Oh, I have a question about this, actually. You guys would be the perfect people to ask this. Last night, I went out with a high school friend of mine, and we were sitting around talking kind of about this stuff. Like, what were the big events of our childhood? Why did we invade Panama?
Noriega was right. Selling drugs, I think, and not through our, I think.
Accepted channels.
And at one point, he threatened to like blow the whistle on George Herbert Walker Bush, who was a CIA director when Noriega was working for us. And I don't know how that worked out. I think it was
cocaine stuff, right?
I'm pretty sure.
Some and then type we of blasted Guns N' Roses 24 hours a day outside his palace, right? To drive him crazy? Yeah.
Yes.
And let me ask you this question, Sam. You're actually the perfect person to ask, as long as we're on this little tangent here. I hope this is okay. Forgive me. Sam, what was the name of the guy who made a name for himself back in the early 2000s, like when I was doing the cartoon? He was repurposing old World War II propaganda posters and making them about the war on terror. And they were very sarcastic and ironic. And he became famous because he told people he was a former Marine who had participated in an air raid in Panama. And then it turned out he made it all up.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know. I have no memory of this at all.
Something. Anyway, that was a Panama tangent.
Since this brain trust has failed, you're going to go to the internet now?
Yeah, I'll try the internet now for a second opinion.
Yeah.
I do remember a guy in, different guy, I think, but in Cambridge, like 10 years before that, 12 years before that, was putting up fake street signs with basically sort of situationist inspired slogans.
I know you were loving that. I was loving situationists.
Yeah, that was a fun time. But
Emma,
all that's gone.
They have fun. Village men, where they half remember things.
Yeah, this is a great podcast or broadcast or whatever this might be.
Poor Emma. This is like going home for Thanksgiving and just like, oh, God.
What was the name of the guy who used to stand on the corner of Harvard Ave and wait for the bus?
That was the other thing.
Mr. Butch. No, that was Harvard Square.
That was the other thing that I really appreciate about the show, because I got to, I got through the first four episodes of season one, and one of them was about the party area up on like in the woods.
Party Pines,
we had that in Worcester, Newton Hill, where it was like people would go up back behind the school, and it was like in the woods, as it were, in Worcester, and there was keggers up there, and that's where people would party. And it just made me think, like, if I went up there today, like, what would people be doing? Like, oh no, we turned it into like actually a little rec area. We've got ping pong,
and our show, the kids turn Party Pines into
TED Talk.
Yeah, they turn it into a TED Talk.
Right.
Sorry, I talked over you there, David Reese.
Oh, Micah, I was gonna Ian say, Wright.
Yes, that's it. That was his name. That was.
Wait a second, Matt. Is that really from Matt? No, that's from Matt's computer.
Yeah.
What?
Panama.
I didn't know that guy. I knew
Ian Wright.
It went viral back in like 2001, 2002.
And by viral, that means it's stickers on lampposts. Exactly.
People printed it up and put it on street poles.
And handed it out to their friends. Yeah.
It was a wacky time because all these little invasions, Operation Just Cause or whatever Panama was called, Grenada. You know, we had just in the late 80s into the 90s, we had just come out of the shadow of the Cold War and the constant fear of nuclear annihilation. And we're getting back into it now. And it's a real nostalgia trip.
Yeah, like totally.
Late 80s and 90s was still a time where like you felt that the promises that were being made, at least to white men, were going to get kept.
Fukuyama stuff.
Yeah, like the economic promises, the idea that if you work, you can make money. If you do this, blah, 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 rent, like, you know, my son who is 16 is watching Friends all the time now. He is absolutely fascinated with it. I think for him, it's like Game of Thrones. Like this is a fantasy world in which people have large apartments and leisure time and a lot of sweater vests and
like careers as opposed to like everybody's working in marketing or driving Uber or something like that.
Yeah. They all have genuine careers and the actor actually is a working actor. The masseuse is actually able to support herself in Manhattan.
Right.
As a freelance masseuse, and that's her only gig. I mean, it's just such a fantasy. It's just, and of course, until Aisha comes on the show later on, zero cast members of color. It was just such a bizarre alternate universe that, you know, I have to tell them, no, that's what it was like. That's a little bit of what it was like if you were in a certain demographic bubble in New York City in the 90s and you felt things will work out, and no one feels that now. And I can't. Yeah. I don't prefer the past, honestly. I mean, what's going on now is terrible, but it's good that we're talking about how it doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah, for this audience in particular, I feel like your show, the politics are right there. I mean, I think probably folks remember David. Get Your War On. Emma, do you remember? I feel like Emma was probably like.
Well, you mentioned Kurt Cobain. You know, he died like 2 weeks before I was born. So
you don't remember watching Kurt Loder's announcement on MTV News in real time in the living room of your college housing?
In utero, I remember it. I mean, look
you
at
felt that. It. Yeah,
that was. Nirvana reference in
I was gonna say that was the name of an album. I'm pretty sure.
See?
That's well done.
So Ben Shapiro calling Joe Biden the Kurt Cobain of politics didn't resonate with you?
You know, we did talk about it a bit. It did not.
Wait, did he say that?
He did.
But it doesn't make any sense
because he's a monster.
Well, yeah, but it was just a reference to the suicide.
Right.
Joe Biden. Oh. Cobain of politics because he's putting the shotgun in the mouth of America and blowing his brains all over the wall, which would mean that he is both America
homicide
Joe Biden, right?
A rare misstep from Ben Shapiro.
a slight rhetorical slip up from a monster.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let me ask you guys, is this on FXX too, or is it on Hulu, or are they the same? What's the deal now?
Well, in these days of corporate synergy. Oh, right. Sorry. You go ahead and say it.
Every Thursday night in March at 10, there's new episodes on FXX, the actual TV channel. And then the next day, those episodes are available on Hulu.
Interesting.
At 4 a.m. apparently.
Yeah. If you don't have FXX. Just stay up till 4 a.m. and then on Hulu, search Dicktown. You'll be able to see the latest season 2 episodes.
I'm glad FX did that because they were late. I mean, not to criticize FX, but like they were late. I couldn't watch FX shows if I didn't have cable for the longest time. But now they have the Hulu thing. Like when The Americans was on, which is one of my favorite shows of all time, it was like it was impossible to watch. And now they're finally, you know, like they figured it out because it's easier with Hulu now.
Yeah, no, there it's
was
all
some
it
big
all goes
FX Hulu Fox deal that changed a bunch of stuff, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Anyway. Well, this is great stuff, but we should do a whole thing about the TV business.
Well, I have to say that we didn't know that there was going to get to be a season 2. And when we found out, we were really excited, but we were also terrified because they told us almost exactly 1 year ago, we want a season 2 and we want it on the air as soon as possible. And so here it is just 1 year later. And that's very unusual for an animated show to compress what had been for season 1, a 3-year timeline between writing scripts, recording, animating, noting, locking in music, recording or creating music. We did it all in 1 year. And to sit down and watch it last night on FXX, a television channel, just really blew my mind. Like, first of all, I can't think of the last time I watched a television channel. And second of all, having it be on a television channel is weirdly meaningful to me. And I'm thrilled
back
that everyone
into television channels.
I know. Like,
go. I mean, it's on the television channel. It is the, as opposed to the streaming thing, right?
Well, it's on both. FXX.
Yes, it is on both.
10 p.m.
Well,
let me ask
you about your production, because I know, like, with Bob's Burgers, we've been, you know, and I haven't done too many during COVID, but it changed the production, the way we did the production, no longer in studio together.
Right.
How do you guys do it? Will you guys record your tracks together, or will you just record the line separately, or what?
We got really lucky. We always like to record together in the same studio, be in the same space, because there's a lot of improvised dialogue and insults and stuff. And we were lucky over the course of the pandemic that whenever it was time to schedule a record session, at least for the two of us, it coincided with a dip in COVID, so I could always fly safely, and if we followed the protocols, we could be in the same studio. And we were also, once I was in New York,
you pod together,
we would bring in other cast members, but there was a lot of remote recording. There was.
Did it change the nature of the show, season 1, season 2?
I don't know if it was the recording particulars that changed. I think the biggest change was just the writing and kind of the ambition of it. I mean, there were definitely times when I wish we could have been in the same studio with the actor instead of sitting in our offices on our laptops directing them. There's no comparison.
Yeah,
but
most,
you know, these people are troopers, and it was deep enough into the pandemic that I think a lot of people were used to it at that point.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, you know, there was no way that we would ever, there were people that we got that we wouldn't have gotten if not for how the whole industry had adjusted to the pandemic. So, you know, Amy Sedaris is in a big story arc this season. Jamie Lee Curtis comes in to do a guest spot, and without being able to record remotely, I don't think they would have been able to do it. So we got lucky there. And, you know, it was a weird transgressive thrill in late June and even earlier, like in April or May, when we started recording, and you know, the case numbers were dropping, like, and people were being in places together again. And it was really moving for David to be able to fly here. And then we would go be in a room and breathe on each other. It was very exciting.
A breath of a close friend.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we probably recorded 17 hours that first day, just breathing on each other. That's our process. Then we start to do the lines.
Then we add just the breathing, and then we turn them into words and sentences.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, I mean, it's good that you have that bank of all the breathing stuff, just in case you ever need to drop it in at different times, I would imagine. Yeah. Over the
well,
show.
We did, get, you know, also being
the ADR,
like, you know, we are podcasters. We have pretty good microphones, respectively. David has Election Profit Makers podcast, and I have the Judge John Hodgman podcast. But what we couldn't do last season was what we did do this time. We were very nimble at the end. We could add lines and record them and send them into the studio, which we could not have done before. They wouldn't have accepted it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was not high enough quality. But they have new tricks to make microphones like the one I'm using right now sound better. So we could adjust lines and add lines and do ADR from home or wherever we might be in ways that we couldn't have before.
What does ADR stand for?
Asynchronous dialogue.
Asynchronous. Okay.
Well, maybe it's additional. It might be additional. You're right, Sam, actually.
I like asynchronous. That sounds good.
I'm going to look
it could be asynchronous, but I think it's additional.
That's it? That feels basic. Additional dialogue recording?
American Depository Receipt from Investopedia. It's a U.S. bank certificate representing shares in a foreign company for trade. So that's it. We're both wrong, apparently.
You know what? You know what it could stand for?
No.
American Dialogue Resetters. And that could be the name of me and Lindsey Graham's think tank, because we're going to reset the dialogue across America. We're going to change people's assumptions about what's possible.
Alternative dispute resolution. It's any procedure agreed to by the parties of dispute. But I like American Dialogue Resetters.
Well, I think that's a great place to end this. With the having settled on the both the name of the think tank and the new meaning of the acronym ADR.
Whoa.
ADR.
Now masterclass.com is telling me automated dialogue replacement. Maybe no one knows what it really means.
Wow. It's just one of those things.
American Dialogue Resetters.
Yeah.
.org.
Guys, I really love the show. Thank you so much
for
coming on.
I really appreciate that.
And would love to have you back on, just because it's a real pleasure to talk to both of you. And
anytime. I hope you know where to find me.
People can see it at any time. They don't have to stay up to 4 a.m.
No, they don't. It's the first episode is on Hulu now. The first two mysteries, I should say.
Oh, we should also say the first season is there, too.
The first season is all on Hulu. It's only 111 minutes long, the whole season.
Yeah, it's 11-minute bites. I mean, it's great.
We're not, it's a binge-let. I mean, honestly. So, I mean, it's about a quarter the length of an Avengers movie. So you can probably watch the first season.
I'm making my daughter watch the show, because she just watches. I want her to watch, stuff that's funny.
That's good dad stuff right there. I'll tell you what.
Well, and tell her we said thanks for watching.
Yeah, you can find it on your browser at bit.ly/dicktown, bit.ly/dicktown, or go to Hulu at any time at your convenience.
God, you're so savvy. So savvy. I know you came up with that bit.ly, and everybody was like, that's a great idea, John. Wow.
Thank you, Sam, because no one has ever said it's a great idea. Most people.
Well, you and I are on the same page when it comes to URLs. I mean, personally, I would have just bought cdicktown.com. instead of the bit.ly, but we're almost there.
Yeah, wonder who owns that one. Contact Sam Cedar. Wow. All right.
Exactly. I did that to Benjamin, actually. For Benjamin's John Benjamin Has a Van, I bought up all the URLs.
You cyber squatted all those URLs
just to fuck with him. It was awesome. He had to
it's
come
fun
to me.
Being a middle aged man.
Yeah, it was fun.
I know, right?
That was it. That was the highlight.
Emma, you know better than anyone.
20 years, just have him come to me like, give me the website. Well,
that's
maybe.
Incredible.
Emma knows better than anyone how great it is to be a middle-aged man.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Take it easy.
Bye, guys.
All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. Or do we got to take a break?
Well, I mean, if you want to head into the fun half, we do.
Freebie Friday.
Whoa.
Freebie Friday. Should we let's just freebie it?
Okay.
Was that how annoying was it? Was that annoying for you?
What?
Just to have these old guys just like being like, hey, remember?
How do I answer that?
You don't have to, okay. Right.
I mean, it wasn't annoying. It's just, I was observing, and then that's about it.
Oh, my God. Maybe we should take a break so we can all gain some composure and come back. I don't think we're going to have time for calls, but we definitely have time for some IMs. Oh, gosh. The voicemail is off.
So maybe turn it back on.
Yeah, voicemail's back on. Let's go to the IMs, shall we?
We shall.
Let's see. Illuminati Kids. I get that Bradley knows that David Rees does experimental noise music and wants to impress him, but he's going a little far with the avant-garde feedback work lately.
Give me a break.
Rude. Sad.
I've got the...
Bradley was picking himself up enough already yesterday, guys. Come on.
I've got the Oscar fever. The Oscar fever. Okay. Some strange news from the internet, but Kentucky's teacher pension is the second largest shareholder of Russia's central bank. Also strange that of the 3.2 million shares, 3 million are owned by Kentucky entities. Sanctions have caused stock price for Spur Bank to drop by 95%. That is pretty nuts. Let's play this clip, Tucker Carlson. One of the interesting things that are happening right now, and we talked about this with Perry Bacon, Will Bunch wrote an article saying, you know, Democrats are practicing political malpractice if they do not capitalize on the relationship that Republicans and conservatives have taken with Russia over these years, particularly in this instance where we are watching this just utter brutality by Putin in bombing civilians. Here is Tucker Carlson, who just literally a week ago, was it?
Yeah.
7 days ago was like laughing. Why should I care? Maybe it was 8 days ago, 10 days.
I mean, we covered it.
Why should I care about
on Thursday, he said, you know, why should I hate Putin? Has he called me a racist? Has he got me canceled? Has he sold me fentanyl? You know, did he create a pandemic? Like he went through a list of things, basically, of grievances from the right that you can't attribute to Putin. And my sense is like it did not poll well, the fact that there were Republicans siding with Putin on this. And there's a very coordinated walk back happening right now.
And here is part of that walk back from last night.
Even spinning out of control. And that, we must be honest, is shocking to us. We've been taken by surprise by the whole thing. We're not the only ones who were, but we're willing to admit it. The only thing more embarrassing.
Pause it for one second. Go back to the beginning. And the idea that when he's got an apology to make, he goes into the royal we. As if he's like, the slight implication is that this is really the fault of my producers, but I'm also going to take some of the responsibility. Go ahead.
Even spinning out of control. And that, we must be honest, is shocking to us. We've been taken by surprise by the whole thing. We're not the only ones who were, but we're willing to admit it. The only thing more embarrassing than being wrong in your estimates is pretending that you weren't. So why didn't we see this coming, this total loss of control? Well, because we assumed that if things were dire, serious people would be involved in fixing them. But we looked up and we saw Kamala Harris involved, and that reassured us. Harris had just come back from Europe, where she'd been conducting, quote, diplomacy with her allies. And that appeared to be proof this could not really be a big deal. The situation in Ukraine had been legitimately serious. If the future of Europe and the world hung in the balance, as now so obviously it does, of course, the Biden administration would not have sent Kamala Harris to fix it, because that's not her job. Kamala Harris's job is to trot down to the Blue Room periodically to greet delegations of TikTok influencers, or to cut occasional PSAs for the Children's Dental Health Awareness Month, which is in February, so we assumed she'd be working on that right now. But averting war with Russia, saving the civilized world, come on. That is absolutely not Kamala Harris's job. That was our assumption. But as noted, we were wrong. Why were we wrong? Well, we spend a lot of time watching Kamala Harris. You probably don't. Unless you are a junior producer at MSNBC, you're probably not that familiar with Kamala Harris. We should say, by the way, we didn't underestimate Vladimir Putin. We overestimated Joe Biden. But we...
That is the most tortured sort of like attempt revisionist history. I mean, the reason why we were completely wrong about the Russians and Vladimir Putin, even though, and we should say, Tucker Carlson has been attempting for years, multiple years, to get an interview with Vladimir Putin, presumably paying attention to Vladimir Putin.
In 2019, he said, why shouldn't I root for Russia? I am rooting for Russia. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that was it. Or that was the quote, mostly.
And who is it that he would like to have been sent? Like, the idea that Kamala Harris was the only person being sent, like, all of the top negotiators were sent too. It's just that we sent the person first in line to be president after Joe Biden to go to basically, even if you want to just call it, like, I mean, she's not sitting down at the table doing the negotiations. That's not the way it works. He knows this. It is such a tortured attempt to divert. And he's just like literally looking around for the first black person he could blame for them. Not for all the time he spent cheerleading Putin. And here's the other thing, too, is that Tucker Carlson spent a lot of time on his show back in the early aughts on Crossfire promoting the Iraq war, even though he was essentially going on radio shortly after that to say there's just the Iraqis are just some backwards, uncivilized monkeys. And he didn't care about, you know, the death and destruction that's happening there. And make no mistake, he doesn't care about the death and destruction that's happening in Ukraine either. He just knows it's not selling well. And so he had to have J.D. Vance on to help J.D. Vance's, like, flagging campaign, because J.D. Vance is running for Senate in Ohio, where it turns out there's tens of thousands of Ukrainian Americans. Probably also take a little issue with the fact that J.D. Vance is like, why should we care at all at this bombing of that's taking place? And so this is Tucker Carlson, and he will get away with it from his audience, without a doubt.
To be fair, Sam, I mean, Tucker Carlson is just extrapolating his, like, white supremacy onto foreign policy here, because he's, like, essentially using the one drop rule to delegitimize the Biden administration, just because Kamala Harris was one of the people involved in like, just being there by her presence. That pollutes the entire well. And so that means the entire Biden negotiation effort with Russia is illegitimate and unserious. Like, that's what he's saying. He's like completely Blinken. Yeah, he was off doing something else, I would guess. Or, you know, he's pretending like she is the big bad in this instance. But I mean, like, that's part of what their effort is, too. They see her as like a vulnerable person to attack. So they're working backwards from that.
Do you think that they, in their producer's room before the show, they're like, we've got to do this. We've got to do this turnaround on our lack, our support for Russia and our lack of support for Ukraine. Ketanji Brown Jackson, is there any way that we can blame her? What about Kaepernick? Is he in the news? Is there any way that we got distracted by Kaepernick and that's why we had too much faith in Putin? Or what? Who can we? Is there somebody? AOC? Could we? Kamala Harris. Yeah, of course. That's what it will be. That's perfect. Great job. Promotion for you. And you can tell those people at Stormfront too. We're using your tip for this today. That's right. What the producer meeting.
Thanks for the help, 4chan Stormfront fans.
Exactly. All right, let's go into...
I want to do the Kennedy thing pretty badly. Yes. Yeah.
Let's do that. Do you want to set it up?
Sure. We weren't able to get to this yesterday, but looking for this on the sound sheet. Which one is it, Bradley?
Seven.
Seven. We weren't able to get to this yesterday, but Sean Hannity went on his radio program and was just throwing ideas at the wall about how the United States should retaliate against Russia. And it's incredibly dangerous. I think it also fits well with what Lindsey Graham had to say today. But first, let's listen to what Sean Hannity said.
What we ought to be focused on is energy and the military. Those are the two things that would matter the most. And we ought to be providing the munitions that are needed, the javelins, the Stinger missiles that would be most effective against this Russian army. Now, as of this morning, this 40-mile convoy of Russian troops and Russian tanks and munitions and fuel, They're only 18 miles outside of Kyiv. And let me tell you, when I look at that, I'm thinking, uh-oh, this is about to become, it's about to go to the next level. And I pray to God Almighty, I'm wrong. And the next level would be a massacre. And the next level would be the toppling of the government of Kyiv. The next level will mean thousands upon thousands and likely tens of thousands of people dead. And that might be on the low side. That's what I fear the most now. Now, you would think that maybe these European countries would get together and they'd be arming the Ukrainians that show that they're willing to fight. You know, if we can see on satellite imagery.
Where pause the- it for one second. Pause it for one second. Pause it. You don't have to take it down. Incidentally, the Europeans are sending weapons. We are sending weapons. Just, I mean, just so you know, Hannity is basically just basically talking about what's been happening and pretending this is his idea as to what should happen. But then he moves into this other thing, which aside from it being incredibly dangerous, also incredibly naive. Keep playing.
Really stupid.
I don't know. Maybe some smart country, maybe NATO might take some of their fighter jets. Or maybe they can use some drone strikes and take out the whole damn convoy. And then nobody takes credit for it. So then Putin won't know who to hit.
Okay, back. So that's it, right? So the idea, like, let's just peel off the USA on the side of the fighter jets that are going to drop the bombs. And Putin's not going to have any idea who did it. Like, oh, okay, so you are 12. You are 12 years old.
I'm going to be honest with you, like 12-year-olds who get into this stuff. I remember kids like that, like a little John Hodgman's probably when they're 12. They like if we could see pictures of this convoy, the idea that like we have no idea who blew it up must have been just like some kid with a drone.
Yeah. Putin would never suspect it. And then here's this Lindsey Graham thing, too. Like, Republicans are just ramping this up slowly but surely in terms of their militarism. This is psychotic. So Lindsey Graham, yeah.
And we should just say, the difference between Graham saying this and publishing it, too, actually, and Hannity is huge because Graham is a... like it or not, a very well-known, powerful U.S. senator.
Yeah. So here's what Lindsey Graham had to say. Is there a Brutus in Russia? Is there a more successful Colonel Stauffenberg in the Russian military? Was that the guy that tried to assassinate Hitler? Right?
I think so.
Yeah. Tom Cruise played him in that movie, I think. The only way this ends is for somebody to in Russia to take this guy out. You would be doing your country and the world a great service. So, like... this guy's, you know, waxing poetically about this publicly, just imagine what the ghouls that are in the deep state or, you know, the Pentagon or
military industrial complex,
industrial complex are thinking about privately. And that's like the cruder form of Hillary Clinton and what we played earlier in the week, where she was essentially saying, why, you know, we can help the Ukrainian people and not explicitly saying that this was her intention, but the war in Ukraine can be elongated so that it bleeds Putin out and he's put in a weaker position than he would be before. And then you have the Republican brutes, not to use a pun because he mentioned Brutus in there, who are just hypothesizing about a cruder form of it. And like, also the naivete of it too. What would be the incentive for said Brutus in Russia to do that, to assassinate Putin? And then without the backing of the United States government, like there would be that kind of person, if that were to happen, they would not be acting alone. They would want assurances and help from the outside because they would almost certainly die. And that is a way to just start World War III in an even messier way.
The worst part of it is not even the sheer insanity that's associated with it. It is that he is giving the Putin exactly what Putin wants and needs at this point, which is a justification
for attacking a country that is posing no threat to Russia. And that justification is, here it is. I told you all along that we were under threat from NATO, from the US. This is the reality. Here you have one of the top officials of the US government basically calling for the assassination of your president. This is Putin speaking to Russia. This is exactly what someone like Putin needs at this point, where there is some concern in Russia, and we don't know how big it is, although we've definitely seen evidence of protests that are significant relative to what Russia usually experiences. This is a way for Putin to justify the entire operation. See, this is the mask off time. They want to basically decapitate Russian leadership, your leader. And that's what the worst part about this is that it gives to the extent that there's nothing that the United States can do beyond arming Ukrainians and providing for refugees and humanitarian aid, et cetera. We cannot engage directly with Russia. But this is, and so the pressure needs to come from ultimately domestic pressure that Putin gets because the war effort is going poorly. If he can convince, if he can mitigate that domestic pressure by saying, look, this is an existential threat to Russia all along. I told you it was. And here's the evidence. That's what is so incredibly irresponsible by Graham.
Yeah.
But here is.
Oh, sorry. Go on.
I want to go back to Hannity just to complete the circle. So what must have happened? The first clip we played of Hannity was on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. What must have happened is after he got off his radio show, somebody said, Sean, they'll know. Like, I mean, if we send a plane, if we send a jet or even a drone, they can be identified. Like, the Ukrainians have access to Turkish drones, my understanding. But the Russians have intel. They'll know it was us. We can't pretend it wasn't us. So he's like, oh, okay, I'll go back on. I'm gonna make it like I'm doubling down, but I'm gonna actually change it a little bit. Here's Sean Hannity, day two, on his radio show of his playing armchair general.
They're valiantly trying to fight back. And thank goodness they have some of the Javelin missiles they need. They don't have enough. Supposedly they're going to get shipments of Stinger missiles. That will be helpful as well. What I don't understand is we've had this convoy, which has really been a focus of concern of mine. And it's a 40-mile-long convoy
of his
of Russian troops and tanks and munitions and fuel. And it's just been stuck. You can Google it on Google Maps for crying out loud, and you know exactly where it is. They're about 18 miles away from the capital of Ukraine, Kyiv. And what I've been trying, scratching my little head, wondering, okay, if they get to Kyiv with all that military might, my prediction is, and you don't have to be a genius to figure this out, is this is going to be a massacre. We can prevent a massacre, and I'll tell you how to do it. Not that hard. We know exactly where it is. Why aren't they taking out that convoy? Not saying America. Now, there are other countries that could join in privately, secretly.
Privately.
There's something in the, you know, the intelligence world called covert operations with something known as plausible deniability. In other words, you do it. You don't leave your fingerprints and you deny you did it, even though you did it. Well, that's lying, Hannity. Are you telling us to countries lie all the time? I'm saying in the face of evil, to stop what will be, if that convoy, as large as it is, makes it to Kyiv, it will be a humanitarian disaster. It will be a massacre. It will go down in history as a massacre. Now that the convoy is stalled and it's sitting there, they're like sitting ducks. And we're not taking out the convoy. I'm not saying we, the United States. Why isn't Europe stepping up and taking out the convoy? They don't have to take credit for it. They can even deny it. But it's an easy military mission from what I can see. And I've talked to commanders. I said, would that be a hard mission? No. With the right, you know, you can do it with drone strikes. You can do it. It's rather simple, actually, they're telling me. Because they're stationary in one spot and they're out in the
open. Pause it. This is just, we don't need him. This is so unbelievably stupid. It is fascinating. It is fascinating to just like watch, like, you know, everybody's now a general. Would it be easy to do if you had a plane? Yes. The problem is the implications of our engaging in that fight. Why send in a covert team to basically do what the Ukrainians could do if they had the military resources? If you can send in a crew of people, because the bottom line is you can't have people on the ground take out the entire thing. The best you can do, which they're already probably doing to a certain extent, is just blowing up a tank here, blowing up a truck there, and relying on the fact that the ground is getting too soft off that road and they can't get past it. That's basically what's happening. It's just mud off the road. And but it is fascinating to hear Hannity talk and talk like this.
I mean, it's like the arrogance of it, too. It's like if we just have one swift kill shot and you're wearing a mask, so Russia's not going to know who it's going to be. But not America. Like he had to backtrack there. I mean, is it beyond Russia to, even if it's not America and if the planes don't have markers on them when they drop the bombs, for them to blame America anyway? Because that would make logical sense. Like, this is kind of fairly standard war hawk arrogance where it's like, we can do it super cleanly. And because of the just almighty power that we display, that people are going to back down, as opposed to just harm reduction when a war like this breaks out. And this kind of thinking is never constructive, even though, you know, he's doing it in a particularly idiotic form now.
It's the keyboard commandos. That's what we're watching again. There was a bunch of this back in the day, too. So yesterday in Florida, there was statewide, and I haven't seen any numbers, but there was enough students who participated in a walkout over this Don't Say Gay bill that would essentially prohibit teachers from talking about sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. And there was a protest throughout the entire state. And this kid, Jack Pedicodes, maybe I'm not saying his name right, Pedogues, who attends Flagler Palm Coast High School, promoted it and was suspended from high school for promoting this protest. He distributed around 200 pride flags for the rally, and he had been advised not to hand out the flags by the school's principal. I'm sure all the free speech warriors will be on this immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Said over 500 students from my school joined thousands of other concerned youth statewide to demonstrate their constitutionally guaranteed right to freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and freedom protest. You know, when the school does it, a public school does it, it actually is a lot closer to the idea of censorship. He added that even though the school administration had permitted the demonstration, their demeanor and tone dramatically shifted as the rally progressed. He said administration began confiscating students' pride flags and attempted to remove them from the campus where he was located. And students in Texas, this is also super encouraging. This is a good news for the weekend. This candidate for District 63, I guess, this guy, Jeff Younger, is a Texas State House candidate. He has been pushing a law to outlaw medical help for young people who want to transition, obviously with their parents' approval, et cetera, and any type of treatment. And he went apparently to the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, to give a talk. And this is the way that students greeted him. It's pretty awesome. This is clip number 11. There you go.
I love it.
Good for them.
Kids
That's
are
pretty
cool.
Awesome. It's generations, just younger people. I think, just better. Just objectively better.
So they were saying F you fascists there, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you play that clip of DeSantis getting mad at like the students behind him for wearing the masks?
Yes.
The guy's a lunatic.
Do you? My question to you is: did you think that that was he knew that the mic was going to pick up him yelling at the kids?
Without a doubt.
Okay.
Completely posturing.
Yeah.
Completely posturing. Here he is. He's doing the same thing. This is all part of his. This is all part of their. Of his run for the Republican primary presidential nominee. Here he is. He's at the University of South Florida. This is from.
So a few kids didn't take off their masks, even though he like screamed, the governor of their state yelled at them to do so.
Yep. And here he is basically going on and saying, you know, saying, well, the only positive thing I could say about the State of the Union is that we have basically pretended that COVID is over.
In terms of the State of the Union, I know you said you felt asleep before it ended, but is there any parts of it you did agree with that you heard?
You know, just for 1 second. Did you hear that question? Like he had already said, claimed that he'd fallen asleep before the State of the Union had ended. Not a vibrant guy. That's like, government sleepy DeSantis. The right. Sleepiness. That's what I call them.
So you gotta take a nap, baby Ron, mini Trump.
Governor DeNapinus.
Why don't you have some of my Adderall, buddy?
Go play it. This is after he's yelled at the kids for wearing their masks.
And right. But these two brave souls behind him, they didn't comply. Right.
F you, Governor.
Ruined his photo op. Love it.
I have to think about some of the stuff. Well, I mean, I agree. You know, if you think about what they've done, Fauci is in the witness protection program now. They don't want him out. They've never supported any. If you listen to them, they never supported all these policies that were so destructive. Now it's like, you know, we all want to be like Florida all of a sudden, and nothing has changed.
What do you mean nothing has changed?
The infection rate has dropped, I mean, precipitously in the past month.
51,000 cases detected yesterday, and we were in the hundreds of thousands on a daily basis just weeks ago.
Except for that part, nothing has changed. Except for the Omicron surge being over, nothing has changed. We still, you know, have... nearly a couple thousand people dying. We're still on the tail end of that. I'm frankly, you know, not convinced that we haven't. I am convinced that we have done this a little bit too early, frankly, in terms of like rolling back all of these different mask mandates. It's all changing in New York, even New York City over the next couple of days, really. But it is what it is. One-way masking, still helpful, as those two kids behind Governor DeNapinus understand.
DeNapinus.
DeNapinus. He said he loves to take naps.
At least Sleepy Joe could stay awake during his speech.
So tired.
What does it take to become a presidential spokesperson? How much knowledge do you need to have of U.S. history, particularly when it involves the presidency?
I would say should be a high bar, but I think it's more about like what your propensity to lie is the number one thing necessary.
Here is Dana Perino with Greg Gutfeld on The Five.
But that?
Well, yeah, because as an American, you never thought much beyond mutually assured destruction. You bomb us, we bomb you. Everything's cool. We've been doing that for 50 years. But Putin is forcing us into a different spot. Do you believe in extended deterrence? Meaning, if we bomb Ukraine, what are you going to do about it? That's not mutually assured destruction anymore. So why does this matter? It's about the no-fly zone. The no-fly zone, he is saying, I will go nuclear if you do this, right? And so that's testing our belief in extended deterrence. And I'm wondering, do we actually believe in this anymore? Should we be believing in it? And is a no-fly zone when it's over, if the country itself is asking for it, how can that be perceived as like an act of war if that's the country asking for it?
It's so interesting because I was thinking this morning about Judge. Maybe you'll get your take on this. We've been playing by the rules on the mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Putin broke the rules.
Yeah. This is
so then do we rethink the rules? I don't. I'm not.
Cuba. Let's do it.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I just got it. Yeah.
Pause it for a second. Okay. So.
I think that's it, right?
First of all. Yeah, we'll get to the fact that Dana Perino like has no idea what he's talking about. But and even Gutfeld talking about like it's not the act of doing a no-fly zone. It is the fact that at one point the chances of a U.S. pilot having to enforce or a NATO pilot having to enforce the no-fly zone means that there will be the likelihood of a confrontation between two planes is extremely high.
Yeah, what happens during a no-fly zone, Sam? Is it just like, you know, it's one of those force fields that goes over Ukraine, you press a button, it's like the Iron Dome, except this one's just, you can't enter.
Literally a dome.
Yeah. Just kidding, that's not what it is. I don't know why Gutfeld's confused about whether when a plane gets shot down by either NATO or the United States, which is what a no-fly zone entails, shooting down Russian planes. Yeah, that is an act of war. Yeah.
And I don't know how Putin has basically said, we're not going to do the mutually. You don't suspend the mutual destruction. It still happens. It's just that it doesn't necessarily have the same impact. But go back to, so now Gutfeld says Cuba. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis was all about the idea of Russia militarizing a country in our hemisphere or providing missiles that could presumably hit the United States. The continental U.S., and we almost had a nuclear conflict about that. So, I mean, really, the idea is everything about he's talking about going in and getting involved in Ukraine that she's talking about would be, in many respects, the functional equivalent, at least relative to that era. She apparently has very little, she's a little slow on the uptake on this. Watch this. Go back a little bit.
Saying, I will go nuclear if you do this, right? And so that's testing our belief in extended deterrence. And I'm wondering, do we actually believe in this anymore? Should we be believing in it? And is a no-fly zone when it's over, if the country itself is asking for it, how can that be perceived as like an act of war if that's the country asking for it?
It's so interesting because I was thinking this morning about, Judge, maybe you'll get your take on this. We've been playing by the rules on the mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Putin broke the rules.
Yeah. This is
so then do we rethink the rules? I don't, I'm not
Cuba. Let's do it.
Well, see, here,
you know what I mean?
I just got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is all out war. There are no polite.
My God, they're lunatics. They're lunatics.
Yep.
Let's read some IMs. Is there anything else that we should get to on this list?
I'm going to check the sheet really quick.
All right. I'll read some IMs while we do this. Psychotropic Masculator. I've been arguing to defund the police since I ended a 12-year run in the infantry back in 2012. Saw our public servants wearing my gear on our streets here at home. So it's really disheartening to see comments about defund the police being called the biggest failure.
I think it's
really the slogan does not articulate the thing, and I can understand that. I mean and to a large extent saw some movement, like in Austin, I feel like they took some of the budget, and maybe in Seattle a little bit, was it? Minnesota, maybe slightly, although then there's reports of them spying. It has not been successful. There was a tiny bit, I think maybe in the New York budget, I'm sure that's back now under Adams, to essentially redeploy some of these funds. But it's discouraging.
I mean, it would help if the president wasn't going out on using his bully pulpit to further stigmatize the movement. That might help, but it doesn't need to pull well everywhere. It just needs to be like a movement that gets it done on the local level.
Emma, first half. Hey, crew, please take my suggestion with the intent in it comes from. Please, please see if Emma can drive the interviews in the first half other than Thursdays as well. She is much better at framing questions and opening up counterintuitive ideas than Sam. Some of my most favorite interviews in the last 2 years have been on Thursdays. Well, then keep watching on Thursdays. There you go. Travis from Pittsburgh. Lamb is worst. He's absolute garbage. Fetterman has actual policies, like you said, Emma. Lamb has opposed most progressive policies while in the House.
Yeah, I think he was making a separate point, but like, Fetterman's good. This is a huge opportunity in Pennsylvania, and I don't want the left to lose sight of the bigger picture here. This is he has national appeal too.
Nick from Philadelphia, documentary recommendation: Bug Out on Amazon Prime. Is about the largest bug heist to ever be pulled off, or was it? Very dramatic. Can't believe I just started working here. Had to share this with the MR community. Love you all. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I follow any of that, but Bug Out. The Dicktown is a really good show. Doodles. Mr. Bacon's assessment that the Democrat the media aligns with as normal will be one of those wins that out aligns with Matt Crisman's 2020 primary postmortem. Bernie had to overcome the United Centrist media front that painted him as the adjacent to violent extremists. Between the 101 and the 5, we can hear you, by the way, just Emma for a second. Attention, shout out to the Animation Guild in LA for their support, their efforts, collective bargaining for more rights. They deserve the same wages as all these production workers, as corporations bank on these films and shows. Check out Maximilian Alvarez's interviews on the Real News Network and his Working People's podcast. Maximilian Alvarez. Echo on Sam at 111. The Reverb at 111. The audio is amazing at 111. Sam on Reverb saying Dicktown should be a drop. Matt is never allowed to take a vacation again. Skippy, Sam, your rant about Disney while it's still fresh in your head. I will do that later.
His rant on Disney.
I may just do my own separate video on that.
You should. It would do well.
Queenie Bobini, I nominate Judge John Hodgman to the Supreme Court. Opportunity lost. Sam, sometimes I think you bring guests on for Casual Friday who you personally want, and honestly, you just want some friends over for a random chat in such cases. This is not Sam Cedar's show, so please see how you can get guests who are more aligned and relevant to progressive politics, left message, and creative, fun, and talented both. Opportunity lost. In fact, you were right in the first part. I very much have always used that segment to bring in people to catch up with that I don't get a chance to see. This is the Sam Cedar show in that respect. And the rest of the stuff, no. Come shower with Crowder. Dude, you're a boomer hanging out with millennials making shows for Zoomers. You're not a creepy Matthew McConaughey. I'm kidding, though. Daredevil.
So much critique these days on the IMs.
I think it could be the same person. Daredevil. Hey, Emma and Bradley, good show yesterday. Technical troubles are the worst. Don't feel bad. Everyone had bad days at work, and kind people won't hold it against you. It sucks when you can't play clips, but some fans will appreciate more opportunities to have their IMs phone calls taken. Left is best. Yeah, I mean, we do 15 hours a week practically on this show. You should be thankful that you get a couple hours where you get some technical difficulties.
Agreed.
Maya, Sam, I think if someone was a bully at 13 or high school and still grew out of it, they were probably dealing with some stuff kids shouldn't have to deal with. So don't be mad at them or hold it against them. My last IM really brought down the mood. Sorry. No, I don't hold it against David. I was teasing him.
Were you Sam yourself? Would you say?
I was a little bit. I was, I mean, in some respects, yeah. It depended on where I was. Fenton's absent father. I'm an animator and always struggled explaining to my family that just because I worked as a company called Titmouse and worked on cartoons for Adult Swim, it doesn't mean that I'm making that kind of adult animation. Ron Quixote. Sam, any thoughts on the labor dispute in Major League Baseball? You know, to be honest with you, I'm bummed. I have not, I really haven't, I'm not, I'm just not familiar enough with it. I haven't had, spent enough time really sort of reading into it just because Emma is here.
Well, baseball is not, like, in terms of my knowledge, that's at the basement of, like, the big four leagues. But I will say this, like, Manfred is by far the worst commissioner in America, like, by far. And the reason he still has his job is because he is a anti-labor lawyer, and he's had that job as a way to suppress wages and suppress the players union from demanding more. And this happens every year, and the fact that he lets it happen every year, not every year but many years, it's just like he's there as a figurehead for the owners to tamp down what the players are asking for. And like, this is why baseball is losing popularity, partly. I mean, like, it's dysfunctional. So it's just the MLB, they have no one to blame but themselves for the way things are going. And like, as they lose money and viewers, this is why.
We got a couple more IMs that we got to get out of here. Doing a pre-tape. Kid Tested Power Bureau approved. I love that interview. It's a perfect Casual Friday one. Thank you. Sam's Lavender Nightmare. Get your war on with seminal reading during the W. Bush era. Yes, David Reeves' cartoon. Are you familiar with it? We talked about it last time it was on.
Wait, what?
Google it. Get your war on. It was huge during the Bush years. Jen Hexer. I've fallen through a rabbit hole of ecstasy to have John Hodgman and Sam Cedar on the same podcast. Jen Hexer. Leave Bradley alone. Harvey Ball, Sam, you were right. To be specific, Newton Hill is now a disc golf course. Is that right? Nuke Wrangler, why are they telling us to watch Dicktown at 4 a.m? Doesn't that show get hard?
It's Nug, Sam. It's Nug Wrangler. Nug Wrangler.
Whatever. custodial artist. I was typing a joke about Benny Boy and his Kurt Cobain comments, but Hodgman beat me to it. Also watched an episode of Friends without the laugh track. It's surreal. And Sam, don't let Emma forget vegan hot dog. Left is best. Slava Ukraini. Okay. Congressional baseball fan. I can't believe you let John Hodgman on and didn't ask him about his opinion on Arby's. The other bridge. I am PC. I am a PC. The other Biden. Sorry. You know that he was the PC guy, right?
No.
You didn't know that? In those commercials, Mac and PC?
Now I've put it together and I remember. I mean, I, no offense to him, I more remember Mac. Like, he was more of the focus of the...
All right.
Maybe it's just because I, you know, he was cute or whatever. I was a kid when those were on.
Oh, Jesus. Josh from Tucson. Shit, Bradley, not Brandon. I don't know. Demian. Saw the Batman last night. I think it was actually quite good, but my buddy bought us tickets for the 4DX, and I was actually spent most of the three-hour movie trying not to be killed in my chair while fake wind and rain assaulted my face and glasses. I dropped my mask at one point because I couldn't retrieve it because I was terrified my hands would be crushed if Bruce Wayne looked in to the left too quickly. 4DX is insanity. I recommend it.
I literally had tickets for tonight, but we had to cancel for other reasons. And so I'm so upset. I don't love superhero. Like, I don't love Marvel, but I will go to a Batman movie, and I'm a huge Robert Pattinson fan, and I've heard good things. So I'm pretty pumped about this one for sure.
I like Batman. I can't do 3D because my glasses.
And also, like, this is a very, Batman's always dark. Like, it's in the night. It's hard to see things. The freaking 3D glasses are like sunglasses. They make everything darker. I'm not going to go and see Batman darker. You can't see anything.
There you go, folks. Hudub, Bradley's doing a great job. Audio is insanely hard and you fix stuff really quick. Ilwayne Grafty. Is Hannity saying Keith? Sounds dank. All right, three more. Jay Bags. Now I'm getting feedback. Sam, what's the more legit acquired taste of Massachusetts? Moxie or Necco wafers? I would say Necco because there's nothing redeemable about them. At least Moxie makes a good whiskey chaser. I totally agree. Although I like Necco wafers a lot. Moxie I never got into. All right, two more. Chardonnay Socialist. DeSantis just mad because all those kids will be bigger than he is in another year. Brendan's puppet photo. Obscure question, but Matt Leck, do you know if a federal agency is allowed to rescind a job offer for marijuana testing in states that legalized it? He's not even here. All right, final IM of the week. Well, let's see. Who are we going to get here? We'll do this. All right, the final IM of the week. Thanks to Dorsey for helping Bradley with the show today. Bradley, Dorsey, Emma, great job today. See you folks on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Heads are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. We'll be right back. shifted in.